From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Congressman Charlie Dent, a Republican from the state of Pennsylvania. And we're coming to you from his office on Capitol Hill. Congressman Dent is serving his sixth term in the House of Representatives, the lower chamber of the U.S. Congress. He is the chairman of the Military Construction and Veterans Affairs Subcommittee for the House Appropriations Committee. He also serves on the Appropriations Subcommittee on State and Foreign Operations and on Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development. On this edition of the program, we'll talk with Congressman Dent about the many domestic and international issues dominating the headlines, including challenges to implementing the Republican legislative agenda amid several ongoing investigations concerning Russian interference in the U.S. election. Congressman Charlie Dent, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. Great to be with Voice of America.
Well, thank you again for hosting us here in your office. Congressman Dent, let me first ask you about your constituency. You're from the state of Pennsylvania. Talk about your constituency and your main legislative priorities.
Yeah, I represent a district in both the eastern and south central Pennsylvania, the areas of the Lehigh Valley, Allentown, and Bethlehem. And that's an area that is traditionally known as an industrial region of Pennsylvania. Steel had been a major industry, and other basic industries were there for a very long time. The area, like many others, has transitioned. My district extends out the Interstate 78 corridor out towards the town of Hershey, which many people are familiar with, which we call the sweetest place on earth, large confectionery area where, you know, they make the Hershey Kisses and chocolate bars and Reese's peanut butter cups, among
yes,
other things.
We love and, it, and thanks for offering those delicious sweets in your office.
Most welcome. And the district actually extends all the way to the Susquehanna River at Three Mile Island, the nuclear plant. And that is the end of the district. By the way, I should note that there's some plans to close Three Mile Island that were just announced last week.
And in terms of your legislative priorities, notwithstanding so much going on in Congress, what do you see as your primary priorities?
Well, as a member of the Appropriations Committee, I'm responsible for making sure that our government gets funded each year. And specifically, I oversee military construction as well as the Veterans Administration funding. So I spend a great deal of my time working on issues of the VA, as well as much of the infrastructure for our armed forces, not only in the United States, but throughout the world, wherever they may be, whether in Germany, where we're rebuilding the Landstuhl Hospital, building a new hospital, or we may be work in Europe on the European Reassurance Initiative, to Japan and Korea, where we have major projects where we're relocating bases in Okinawa and also in South Korea out of Seoul, to various other projects throughout the world and in the Middle East. So that's where I spend a lot of my time. Also, I serve on the subcommittee dealing with the State Department and foreign operations. So I work to make sure that our diplomatic corps is funded and that we have the resources necessary to provide for enhanced security, for example, at our embassies and diplomatic missions throughout the world. We also deal, of course, with the foreign assistance budget and development budgets as part of those responsibilities. And finally, I deal with issues of medical research, transportation, housing. These are other areas I've focused on quite a bit during my time in Congress.
Well, Congressman Dent, I would like to pick up on your budgetary responsibilities, particularly with respect to President Trump's proposed budget. As you know, he has proposed severe cuts for the very department that you oversee, that is the State Department. I would like to get your view on those proposed cuts, particularly because we understand that the uniformed military say that they would like to have a robust State Department to help support their efforts.
Well, I've served with three presidents, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and now Donald Trump. And I've said this with each president, that the president proposes and the Congress disposes, that the president will propose a budget and Congress will take a look at it. We'll take the things we like, we'll accept the things we like, and we'll discard the things that we don't like. And that will be the case this year. As it relates to the State Department, many of us have certainly been critical of the massive reduction to the State Department. In my view, and we've heard Secretary Mattis, when I guess he was General Mattis, and I heard General Petraeus and former Secretary Gates all kind of say similar things, that if we do our development and diplomatic missions effectively, that will lessen the need for them to buy bullets, more or less summarizing what they've said, but you get the point. And I've often said that we have a three-legged or a three-headed national security strategy that includes diplomacy, defense, and development. Development being the smallest piece, but we need to do all three effectively. That we can't solve all of our problems internationally through hard power. That certainly soft power is absolutely essential, you know, arrow in the quiver, you know, of American national security policy. So bottom line is, we will have Secretary Tillerson meet with us imminently in our state foreign ops appropriations meeting. He will come in and make the case, and I will be sure to ask him how would he propose reducing State Department funding by a third. And we'll look at his proposal and we'll say, well, how will this affect operations and the impact? So bottom line is I'm less worried about the president's budget. I get more concerned about whatever the House budget may include. Specifically right now, I think it's imperative that Congress enter into a bipartisan budget agreement that would establish the funding level for fiscal year 18. And we'll do that independent of the president's proposal. But we need to do this and do it fast. That way we can then write our appropriations bills at responsible levels.
Congressman Dent, in a related question, some people are worried about the slow pace of appointments by President Trump, that is, appointments to senior positions within the State Department and within many other departments. Are you equally concerned about the slow pace of these very senior appointments?
Yeah, I mean, there's two issues. There's been a slow pace of making the nominations by the administration, and then some of the nominations, once they've been to the Senate, gotten to the Senate, have been slow walked by some of the Democrats. So we have two issues there. So to the extent that positions aren't being filled rapidly enough, that diminishes the ability of the administration to implement its policies, whatever they may be. So, I mean, I think that's really the bottom line. If you don't have your people, if people aren't in place, you know, in the various departments and agencies, it's very difficult to implement your agenda. So it is of concern.
I want to go back to your constituency because it relates to another policy or a proposal by President Donald Trump. If I'm not mistaken, there are quite a number of Syrian refugees in your district.
They're not refugees. We've had a Syrian community, a strong presence for a long time. Most of the Syrians who come to my district do not come as refugees. They come as immigrant visa holders, primarily.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you. Is that community advocating for perhaps an absorption of some refugees from Syria?
I think I can state fairly that my Syrian-American constituency is split on the issues of refugees. The Syrians who live in my district, primarily in the Allentown area, are largely of the Christian faith, overwhelmingly, actually. And so many of them are more sympathetic to the Assad regime, believe it or not, much more sympathetic. And so we've had various articles in our local media hearing from some local residents concerning some of the issues they have with Sunni refugees. And so some of them are split. There's two opinions. Some of the Syrian clergy, Christian clergy, are saying these refugees are our brethren. It's our obligation to help our Syrian brethren. And others, they will say we're Syrian Christian. You know, we are more sympathetic to the Assad regime. These folks are anti-regime, and they have not been as willing to help. So bottom line is they're divided like much of the rest of the country is on the refugee matter. But some of the Syrians have been very helpful, though, with some of the... We haven't had that many refugee families come in, to be perfectly honest with you. We haven't had that many refugee families. My office, though, does spend a great deal of time dealing with Syrian immigrant issues routinely, because I have many requests for people trying to come into our country. And that was the case even prior to the Syrian civil war.
All right. Well, what about the so-called travel ban? We know that President Trump has issued or has proposed this travel ban. It's in the courts now. It's being, you know, looked at by the courts. What is your position on this proposed travel ban? What impact would that have?
Well, the initial travel order, or it was a travel moratorium or a travel ban, call it what you will, I had criticized it at the time when it came out on a Friday evening back, I think it was in January, early February, I've forgotten the actual date. But when that first came out, I was very critical because to me it had been rushed. It was, in my view, haphazardly constructed and hastily implemented, and it had created a crisis at many airports. I had been contacted by some local Syrian-American family in my district who had six family members who were immigrant visa holders, who were soon to be green card holders, and they happened to be Christian. And they boarded planes in the Middle East with valid visas. When they landed in Philadelphia, they had been revoked. So they were basically turned around in midair. They were revoked in midair and then ultimately sent back. Now, we've since had them returned here. It was a very unfortunate situation. But my point was that the order was hastily constructed and it was very haphazard in its implementation. And I said that that order should not be enforced and that a more thoughtful policy had to be considered. Now, there's been a new order submitted. I still have questions about the need for this particular order. I know they've identified six countries for this moratorium. I helped develop that list of six countries when we were dealing with separate legislation a few years ago. But that list of six countries is really dealt with for the purpose of citizens of European countries who were at that time traveling down to Syria to sign up with ISIS. And the idea there was that not to necessarily ban travel from those countries, but if anybody from a European country with whom we have the visa waiver program, if anyone had gone down, a British citizen or a French or German citizen, Dutch, Belgian, had gone to Syria over the previous 5 years, we said that they came back to Europe, the visa waiver program would not apply to them, that they would have to go to, those individuals would have to go to our consulate or embassy and be screened, further screening. That's all we did. It was not meant for a travel ban, but that's what those six countries are for. So there's some confusion about that. They said, well, Congress designated those six countries. And I said, well, yes, we did, but for a different purpose. And I think that's the point I wanted to make. So bottom line is, I never thought that this was an effective way to deal with the challenges that we're facing. Candidly, I believe that our greatest security threat from the Islamist extremists would come to us, to the United States, from Europe, where there are individuals who are currently citizens of European countries who are already radicalized and can enter the United States on a passport. That is our most serious vulnerability. And of course, I can make a case, too, that we go throughout the Middle East and where there are, you know, very strong Muslim countries, you know, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, which are not on the list. But I do understand the six countries identified, you know, we have either limited relationships with the governments there or no relationship, you know, depending on which countries. But bottom line, there are secondary and tertiary effects to the original travel order that were not well thought out. I'll give you an example. In my district, in my state, I should say, there was an Iranian child. There was a cancer issue, and Children's Hospital of Philadelphia was to treat this individual. And this child, you know, was going to be coming in on a medical visa. Well, that person was not permitted to board a plane. Okay, now that was that's one example. Or another, a CEO of a major Fortune 500 company in the United States who has a very strong presence in our country with thousands of employees and thousands of employees overseas said, you know, we have executives who couldn't board planes because they may have been Syrian nationals or passports, but living in the UK or France or wherever, but were unable to travel. And so that would cause these companies then to change the locations of their meetings to Canada or to Europe. And so there are these types of effects. I didn't, and of course, there was the student and faculty issue that we were dealing with. So I've been critical of the order, and I don't question the president's ability or his authority to, enter into this kind of initiative. I mean, he has that authority. The question is it good policy or not?
Exactly. And of course, you make many of the same points that I've heard counterterrorism experts say are very important, which is that it's not just the nationality. That alone doesn't determine whether one is a danger. There are many, many other factors that are far more important. But let me turn to another issue, Congressman Dand. As you know, last week there were lots of hearings. James Comey, the former FBI director who was fired by President Trump, took the stand, many other hearings and investigations related to Russia's interference in our elections last year, their attempts to really undermine our electoral process, our confidence in the U.S. democracy. You put out a statement in favor of the nomination of a special counsel, Robert Mueller, to lead the FBI investigation. I'd just like to get your view of these ongoing investigations. What do you make of them, and what do you expect to result?
Well, there have been so many issues surrounding this whole Russian meddling matter. First, let me say this. I think it's clear it's unambiguous that the Russians did attempt to meddle and intervene in our election. That, I think, is an established fact. We also know that the Russians were attempting to harm one candidacy, Hillary Clinton's candidacy. I'm not saying they're trying to help Donald Trump, but they're certainly trying to hurt Hillary Clinton. So by hurting her, they were helping Donald Trump, I guess. But bottom line is, there was no question that they had an issue with her. So those two facts we know. Now, what is under investigation is, to what extent was there any collusion, perhaps, between the Trump campaign, and these Russians? At this moment, I'm not aware of any evidence that suggests there was collusion, but let's let the investigation play itself out to determine whether or not there was any collusion. And of course, there are other issues that I suspect are being investigated too. You know, is there any interference or obstruction, potential obstruction, you know, as it relates to the investigation? But right now, it seems like there is more smoke at the moment than fire. But oftentimes with these investigations, it becomes the interference or the obstruction that becomes the central issue more than the underlying matter.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. We're talking with Congressman Charlie Dent, a Republican from the state of Pennsylvania. He's chairman of the Military Construction and Veterans Affairs Subcommittee for the House Appropriations Committee. He also serves on the Appropriations Subcommittee on State and Foreign Operations and on Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout-out to Samuel Muzunguzi from Imbarara, Uganda. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Congressman Dent, what do you think is the specific role of the House of Representatives Intelligence Committee with regard to the Russian probe? Because we know the FBI is doing the investigation under Robert Mueller, Senate Intelligence Committee. What about your branch of Congress, the House Intelligence Committee?
Well, the House Intelligence Committee and Senate Intelligence Committee are each conducting their own investigations. You know, on the criminal side, of course, that's the FBI. They would deal with that. And they're also, as far as I know, conducting a counterintelligence investigation as well. What the Congress is trying to do is simply trying to get to the facts. What exactly happened? Now, when the House investigation got off on a wrong track, you know, the chairman had to recuse himself. And because of that, I thought at the time that it might be difficult for the House to produce a bipartisan report. But the Senate under Senators Burr and Warner seemed to be on a better trajectory. Although now that Mike Conaway has taken over the investigation in the House, along he and Adam Schiff, I think, are putting that investigation back on track again, probably a little bit behind where the Senate might be right now. But all we want to do is get to the facts, get to the truth. I just want to know what happened. You know, the FBI will determine whether or not there was any criminal wrongdoing. But again, from Congress's point of view, I think we just need to know the extent to which a hostile foreign power attempted to intervene in our election, which I think every American should be outraged by. And we should be prepared then to, you know, hold the Russians to account, depending on what we find.
Indeed. Well, speaking of the Russia probe, this certainly is going to have an effect and is having an effect on the legislative agenda. What do you think are the effects of these hearings and investigations on the Republican House agenda? How concerned are you that they're going to distract from your legislative agenda?
Well, there's no question that this whole Russian issue, not necessarily the investigations, but maybe all the tweets and all the other noise, you know, the Comey firing, all the issues surrounding that issue, all these things are, I think, diverting attention away from the agenda. Now, we have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. We must be able to conduct these investigations, House, Senate, and the Justice Department, independent prosecutor. They should be able to conduct their investigations, and we should be able to compartmentalize this to some extent. But I'm hoping that the administration, you know, just remains quiet. Every time there's a revelation, you know, there's a Twitter storm and a lot of comments being made. I think that they have to be much more disciplined in how they respond to every news flash on the Russia matter. And I think they have to compartmentalize, exercise better discipline in terms of how they talk about it. Because if they don't, then the media cycle, the whole narrative, is dominated for days and sometimes weeks just about Russia, and it distracts us from dealing with infrastructure or tax reform or budgets and appropriations bills that we need to do.
And healthcare as well, and healthcare, I'd like to ask you about that.
Yeah.
So now we have the American Healthcare Act proposal was passed by the House of Representatives. You're on record as opposing this proposal. You're saying that you hope that the Senate can modify it. Why are you opposed to this proposal?
Well, the bill that passed the House, in my view, left too many Americans without coverage. Specifically, I was concerned that the Medicaid changes did not provide a soft enough landing to states like mine, Pennsylvania, that had expanded Medicaid under the health care law, that many people were going to be cycling off of Medicaid, put into these exchanges, and then the tax credits, or the subsidies, but they would be turned into tax credits, would not be sufficient for a lot of people to buy insurance. Therefore, they would be without coverage. You know, like, so that was my principal concern. There were other concerns, but the loss of coverage and the inadequacy of the tax credits for many lower and moderate income working Americans were the main concerns that I had.
Are you in favor of repealing and replacing Obamacare? Would you have preferred perhaps a tweaking thereof?
Well, I think we have to be a little bit more careful in our language. I know that term repeal replace has been used a lot. I've said parts of this law will probably need to be repealed, parts of it replaced, parts of it repaired, reformed, and overhauled, and parts of it retained. I mean, I think that's where we are. We all agree that the individual insurance market is in a bad place, that it is failing, and that we need to fix that at the very least. There are certain taxes or pay-fors in the health care law, the Obamacare, that people on both sides of the aisle would agree are problematic, that add to costs, and we might want to repeal some of those items. So I think we have to be a little bit more nuanced in our language about partial repeals, partial replacements, repairs, reforms, overhauls, and retentions. You know, we all want to protect people with pre-existing conditions. We certainly want to make sure that individuals up to the age of 26 can stay on their parents' policies if possible, lifetime caps and annual limits. We want to make sure that those don't return. And so there are certain things that are agreed to, and I think we can try to work health care reform from the center out. If this cannot be done on a partisan basis, I hope the Senate can do better. We'll see if they can do anything at all. I don't know. But I think we might want to try a center-out approach at some point.
Paris Climate Agreement.
Yeah.
The United States just withdrew from that agreement. We know it's going to take many years. But President Trump weighed both sides of the equation and decided to pull out. Was that a good idea in your view or not?
Well, I always feel it's better to have a seat at the table than not have a seat at the table. And now, the Paris Agreement, flawed as it is, was an agreement that was largely voluntary, not mandatory. Frankly, I thought, and I agree with the president on this point, I thought that, you know, that China and India got a pretty good deal. They basically only agreed to what they were already planning anyway. And a lot of the carbon reduction limits for the Chinese anyway, I think, don't take effect till 2030. So in many respects, the deal wasn't what I would have liked. But at the same time, from a position of international leadership, it's important for America to remain engaged on this issue and to stay at the table. So I think it would have been better to stay in than to come out. But I think substantively, I don't know that it'll make a huge amount of difference. What I mean by that is that the United States ended up not being a signatory to the Kyoto Protocols. And we, the United States, exceeded the goals that were set for us in terms of carbon reduction. And it happened largely because of innovation and technology. And I suspect the same will happen going forward, that the United States will continue to be a leader on carbon mitigation strategies, but it'll be largely driven by the private sector, innovation, technology, and just as has been the case up to this point.
And interestingly, many executives and other groups of cities, for example, even the city of Pittsburgh in your state of Pennsylvania, said that, contrary to what the president said, that they're going to comply with the Paris Accord and go forward with the renewable energy strategies.
Yeah, and truthfully, in a state like Pennsylvania, in the Pittsburgh area in particular, that's a hotbed for natural gas development. I mean, the Pittsburgh airport, for example, is sitting right on top of a lot of natural gas, and which they're drilling there and helping the viability of the airport. So natural gas development, American natural gas development, Pennsylvania natural gas development has been one of the key reasons why the United States is able to lower its carbon footprint very significantly. And nobody foresaw this gas boom back at the time of Kyoto in 1999. At least I've always said, if anybody had said that in 2017 we'd be using natural gas back then, if they had said that we'd be using natural gas to electrify the country, I would have thought they were crazy. But today, we'd be crazy not to electrify the country with natural gas, given the development and the low price, the low cost of gas. So, yes, we all support expanding alternative renewable forms of energy, but we also recognize that we will need to continue to use conventional sources of energy, natural gas, coal, oil. They're going to be part of our future as well, and probably a larger role for gas.
Before we close, yeah. Congressman Dan, I wanted to turn briefly to the Middle East. Last week, we saw an attack on the Iranian parliament. The Islamic State group says it was responsible for a pair of high-profile attacks targeting the country's parliament and the shrine of the late leader Ayatollah Khomeini. What is your reaction to this phenomenon?
Well, we must condemn in the strongest terms any ISIS attack, whether it's against innocents in the United States or Europe or in the Middle East. And regardless of faith, you know, sometimes they're attacking people who are largely in Christian communities. Sometimes they attack their fellow Sunnis. And in this case, they attacked Shiite sites. And no matter what the case, we have to condemn these. ISIS remains a cancer on humanity, and we must do everything in our power to defeat them once and for all. They hate a lot of people. They hate people who don't adopt their perverted view of the world. And like I said, then the truth is we know that Muslims primarily are more likely to be the objects of the attacks in many cases, certainly in the Middle East, of ISIS attacks. And that's what we saw in Iran. And that's where we've seen elsewhere in the Middle East. So, you know, we not only have to defeat, but we have to destroy ISIS. That requires more than a military solution. We have to defeat them ideologically, too. You know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, yes, we had a strong military force, as did they. But we waged a war of ideas against the Soviet Union. And it was an ideological war. And we won the ideological war. I believe that, you know, in a country like ours where we have Hollywood and Silicon Valley, we should be able to drive a message digitally or in any way through Voice of America, in any way possible, you know, to defeat these folks ideologically. And I've been surprised and astonished, frankly, about just how sophisticated ISIS is and other Islamist extremists are at driving a message. Sadly, effectively, from their point of view, I mean, because they've been able to radicalize a lot of folks, largely on the internet. The attacks that we've had in our country, in many cases, have been homegrown terrorists. And so ISIS has been, you know, devilishly effective in communicating. And we've got to get better at it. And it's not just for us in Western nations that become better at driving these messages. We need to make sure that particularly that the Sunni nations of the Middle East are leading the ideological fight against ISIS. I mean, it's most important that they do so as fellow Muslims.
Well, that leads me to my last question, Congressman Den, and that's regarding this decision by a number of Arab nations to isolate Qatar diplomatically, the country of Qatar, saying that, you know, Qatar is allegedly supporting Iran and other Islamist militant groups who are sponsoring terrorism in the region. And, of course, President Trump, in a sense, sort of supported this decision and praised these countries for isolating or attempting to isolate Qatar. And then other critics say, well, this is a delicate thing to do because, of course, you know, the United States has over 110 U.S. personnel in Doha and that we have a major military base there. And from that base, the United States conducts a number of counterterrorism operations in the region. Do you see a way where we can, on the one hand, yes, condemn Doha, Qatar for perhaps encouraging terrorism or supporting Iranian militias, at the same time, you know, try to not to antagonize them because we have this important military base there?
Well, you're right. We do have a very delicate relation with Qatar. We do have a very robust military presence there, particularly air power presence. I do think that we are going to have to, you know, resolve this matter diplomatically. Many of us in the United States have been critical of Qatari involvement with funding some bad actors in Syria, as an example. That has been an issue, you know, with radicals who became armed. And so there has been an issue with some in Qatar. I'm not saying necessarily the Qatari government. I'm saying but with people from Qatar. So there is an issue there. There's a legitimate issue to be raised. At the same time, Qatar and the United States do enjoy a partnership in many respects. And we have some shared interests with the Qataris who have, you know, provide us with space, you know, for us to carry out missions. And we use that space, you know, to project power in the region. So I'm hoping we can arrive at some kind of a diplomatic solution on this. And I hope that the Qatari government gets the message that there are those, not only in the United States, but particularly in their own neighborhood, you know, who have some very serious concerns about their apparent support, at least some people's support in that country, of some bad actors. So we need to all sit down at the table and try to hash this thing out.
Congressman Charlie Dent is a Republican from the state of Pennsylvania. Congressman, thank you so much for your terrific insights.
Well, thank you, everyone, on the program. Appreciate all the good work you do at the Voice of America.
Thank you so much. Congressman Charlie Dent is a Republican from the state of Pennsylvania. Congressman, thanks again for your time and terrific insights.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer and producer was Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.